us the sacred myth, stalks the limits of my living room, and cuts me clean in half. Oh, time, time, minute hand spins you around the plane, spins the big machine as it descends again. Every tortured day,
good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A great group this morning. We have a lot to discuss, a lot to talk about, and we welcome your letters. We'll get to how you can join us in just a second. Real quick, we were hearing Kaya Cater, who is playing Troy Savings Bank Music Hall on Friday, November 30th at 8 o'clock, troymusichall.org. And it'll be the music you'll be hearing throughout this morning. Let Rich rock out.
It's challenging, but I'll try I'll try it. I can adapt.
Well, we'll see. I know. Oh, my God. We know you can adapt. Let us introduce the panel, and then we'll get going here. We are thrilled to have our good friend Rich Honan back, corporate attorney and a frequent but not frequent enough guest on our program, and we're very happy to have you here today.
I'm happy to be here. Some would say too frequent.
No one here says that. Good morning. How are you? Good to
I'm
see
well.
You.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Jen Smith is here. She is a Berkshire Eagle reporter. She is one of the finest journalists in our region. We are thrilled to have her join us each and every week. Good morning, Jen.
Well, thank you very much, Joe, and good to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program as well. Terry Gibson is also with us almost every Wednesday. Check your calendars. It's Wednesday. He's here. Former New York State Senator, SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you on the program. And WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us as well. Good morning, Alan.
Yo, Joe.
Good to have you. How are you making out? You doing all right? Everything fine?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, if you want to get on the conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And let's go to what is happening in the world. So the big interesting story is the one that comes out of the New York Times, where Paul Manafort's lawyer is said to have briefed Donald Trump on the Mueller talks. A lawyer for Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, repeatedly spoke with the president's lawyers. The highly unusual arrangement appeared to give Mr. Trump and his advisors ammunition in their public campaign against the special counsel Robert Mueller. This all comes as the news about Paul Manafort and not cooperating with, as promised, not cooperating with the Mueller team. Rudolph Giuliani, one of the president's personal lawyers, acknowledged the arrangement on Tuesday, defended it as a source of valuable insights into the special counsel's inquiry and where it was headed. Such information could help shape a legal defense strategy, and it also appears to give Mr. Trump and his legal advisors ammunition in their public relation campaign against Mr. Mueller's office. However, some legal experts speculated that it was a bid by Mr. Manafort for a presidential pardon, even as he worked with the special counsel, Robert Mueller, in the hopes of a lighter sentence. Rich, I immediately thought of you when I was reading in the story last night, because I just thought to myself, well, isn't this what you do?
It's exactly what you do. I've done it in criminal investigations where I had the guy who was the target and other people were being interviewed, even pre-indictment. Like if the IRS or if the SEC is talking to people, of course you always call their lawyers and say, you know, what are you comfortable telling me? What were they asking about? I was amazed. I think it's the Times makes the very unsupported statement that this is somehow an unusual move. I think it would be unusual if they were not cooperating. Right. I don't understand that.
And now, and that fits into your narrative that this has always been about a plea deal and a pardon for Manafort.
Always. Never promised you a rose garden.
Right.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. Yes.
Yeah, I beg your pardon.
Dance to that, Rich.
Yeah, that's right. That's what this has always been about. This guy's playing both sides of the street. And if you or him. I would hope you wouldn't be, or that anybody else wouldn't be, because he's really, you know, as my mother used to say, déclassé. he's holding out for a pardon. Now, do I think Trump is capable of giving him a pardon? Yes, I do. I think that, you know, my often used analogy to the rat in a corner has been, you know, you get a rat in a corner, he's going to bite your hand if he can. And if he, just because that's what's available to him. So I do think that this is about a pardon. I think that Mueller is obviously furious with him because they expected more in terms of allegiance. But of course, from a guy like that, you're never going to get it.
So let me ask about that, Rich, because yes, that is a part of the story that Mueller was furious about it. And not only this aspect of the story, but also not staying with the original arrangement. And I mean, you guess you can understand that as well.
If indeed he did not stay within the original arrangement, if the original arrangement was, and I assume it was, you will testify to what you know, and give us information on what you know, and he testifies to what he knows, but it's not what they wanted him to say.
Well, they're saying he's lying.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, right? I mean, if he's lying,
let's say he was lying.
It could vitiate his plea deal, sure. But
great Scrabble word, Jen. Vitiate. Yeah, go ahead.
I just mentally marked that.
Go ahead.
It's very possible that he's just not giving them the answers that they had hoped he would give, which is usually the push and pull. Usually, you know, when you get a plea deal, you say, look, we'll talk about this, this, and this. And then, you know, you do your deal and then they talk about it. But, you know, if you don't have the information that they want, you can't make it up.
But there's a whole history here of this guy getting himself into trouble. That's why he's in jail right now.
In solitary confinement.
Yep.
Yeah, because he didn't do what he was supposed to be doing. So, you know, this is a guy who doesn't mind bending the rules, Rich.
I don't know if that's true. That may be true. He's been convicted, so I think you have to go with that. But I take a step back, and I'll ask the communications professor, but is this... To me, and I don't want to use the F word, but this seemed like the fakest of fake news because this is something defense attorneys talking to each other, defense attorneys talking for a target talking to a witness or other witnesses. To me, that happens all the time. I don't understand how the Times can make this unsupported statement that somehow this is unusual.
Well, I don't think that the general public could be expected to know what the usual is in this type of situation. I think that I think you raised some good points. I think maybe if this is indeed a usual situation, that the press does have some responsibility to be more clear about that. However, I think just from the communications point of view, I think one of the things I'm interested in, and I'd ask you, is how the president has used the information that he appears to have received from these conversations to develop his messaging in his tweets. Is there any type of conflict of interest from a legal point of view, in your opinion?
I don't think so, unless he uses it to actually, you know, as we say, re-engineer the facts, right? You can't do that, right? You can't say, well, they're looking at this, so I'm going to change my story on this. But if, for example, they're looking at this, you know, the 2016 Trump Tower meeting or something like that, sure, he might tell his team, I'm on absolutely solid ground on this. So we could hammer away at that if that's
yes,
what they're looking at.
But Rich, the aggressiveness of the tweets has to show fear, as far as I'm concerned. In other words, based on what we think is going on with the Mueller investigation, and what he's hearing, the tweets are getting more furious.
I mean, what we saw yesterday in the tweets, and what we saw what he said, and I really please, if you have a chance, read the transcript of the Washington Post interview with the president. It is it's worth the price of admission. But to Alan's point, how do you not if that is what is coming out, the president is simply said he's not acting like he's not guilty. Is that how an innocent man acts?
Is that how Trump acts?
Yes.
I would think that an innocent person accused of a crime, if you take that the innocent person is accused of a crime that she or he did not commit,
yes,
and they react violently to that accusation, I don't know how else they would act.
Do you see it differently, Alan?
Yeah, Rick, just for clarification, are you talking about the president reacting violently or Manafort?
The president.
The president, because you were talking about the violence of his tweets. I don't know if you guys are measuring
When is the last time that you saw him accused? In other words, you say he's accused. Has Mueller accused him of anything? I don't think so.
Is this your best argument, Alan? Because we're kind of thinking, if you're taking the position, Trump has never been accused of anything, I think.
Been an investigation into his activities.
Sure.
But has there been a formal accusation of any kind that the president did wrong or did anything criminal or the rest of it from an authoritative individual? I don't think so. So the fact that he's coming out the way that he is, either in the Washington Post or on the tweets, says, the rat is cornered.
That sounds terribly Orwellian to me, that if somebody protests their innocence, you're going to use that as an indicia of their guilt. I kind of wonder, what would you expect somebody to do?
The man is president of the United States, for goodness sakes.
I know. I voted for him.
Oh. Is that the first time we've heard that?
No.
But I will say, the first negative email came in within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so. It was a good one, too. But
it was a good one.
We just
can't read it on
the air. I shared it with Rich, and he laughed, and then I deleted it. Terry.
But it was a good one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I also think what's interesting, just, I guess, in the optics of this announcement is the reemergence of Giuliani. I feel like just last week we were on the show talking about where the heck has Giuliani been? And right. And then this is like he's come out as being like the intermediary of all this. So, I mean, like it does make you question, you know, really what is going on, and because he doesn't represent Manafort. So why is he involved? That does raise an eyebrow for me.
And when he seems like he's the calm in the storm, well.
you think that's what he seems like?
Just in this particular case, I think over the last 24 hours of the way he has sort of tried to straddle the fence.
Well, in the last 24 hours, he's reemerged on my three worst people in the world list. That's all I got to say.
He actually left the list for
a short time. He was quiet, so there were other people to put in there.
I just think it's just so unusual, bizarre, unprecedented that what appears to be happening is that the President of the United States is getting inside information through these communications that deal with an ongoing investigation, and he seems to be sharing that information to some degree in his communication to the public. To me, that while it certainly may not be illegal, it seems disturbing and problematic at very many different levels.
But in addition to that, the Manafort backdoor, there is also the other guy. What's his name? You know, the assistant who
Papadopoulos?
No.
Corsi.
Yeah, Corsi. Who said that he was going to be entering into negotiations with the Mueller people?
Oh, right.
Remember that?
Yes.
And then all of a sudden he said, "I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do." And that is interesting because there's a certain commonality between the Manafort and the Corsi, meaning that they're working that backdoor operation in both cases, in my opinion.
Oh, I think it would be malpractice for his attorneys not to be. At least I think it would be malpractice for Corsi's attorneys not to be talking to Manafort's attorneys.
So what is it? Rich, what is it that motivates a guy to turn around and say, first, to every news media who will listen, part of the news media, I'm going to negotiate with Mueller, and then all of a sudden I'm not, and I'm. That sounds like a playbook that comes out of the White House to me.
It's weird. I will say, as someone who I'm not a court reporter, but I have covered court things. And as a reporter, you know that this happens between lawyers. You as a reporter might even talk and see what they'll say to you about that. But it because nothing is certain, doesn't really become public information to Terry's point. And that's why I think it does seem unusual. And because it then does get, disseminated in the Twitterverse is also sort of it's a peak that we don't really get. But I think you also just have to look at the bigger picture of moving forward. You know, what does this all mean? What are really the facts at hand, and where is this leading to, you know, any revelation in the Mueller investigation?
Well, the only thing that has happened in recent modern history that, to me, comes close to this is Watergate. And we did see a president being cornered at the time. We did see him reacting in similar ways. And we saw how that worked out. And so if this works out the same way as that did, then I'm a very happy person. But we've yet to see whether that's going to happen or not.
See, I would draw the parallel to that, but also to the Clinton investigation, the Bill Clinton investigation, just because... And many others, you know, Martha Stewart, all of them, where you see how when an investigation starts, and I think this might be an answer to what you bring up, Jen, when an investigation starts, first of all, you as the target have all these people talking about things, and you have no usually you have no forum to, you know, to be able to combat them. But the other thing is there's all these ancillary things that happen during the investigation, meaning people are asked questions. People who are meant to be witnesses are asked questions, and they give stories that are not that don't match up, and then they end up getting you know, obstruction or perjury charges or things like that. And we saw that a little bit, you know, in the Clinton case. We saw, you know, the mission creep from, you know, Whitewater, right, to where the thing actually went. So I agree with you. I think there's some parallels both to Nixon as well as Clinton.
And Joe, could I ask really quickly?
We have a minute.
One diversionary moment, and that is that my next wonderful next door neighbor Annie asked me this morning whether I thought that the president would be impeached, and I said that's the last thing the Democrats want. Right now, they've got so much going. They just won, I think, 40 seats above in the Congress. Why would they want him out of there?
Rich is shaking his head.
I don't know what the thinking is on that.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand Alan's point. I mean,
point is it's a politically advantageous for them to have the president as crippled as he seems to be right now, and is with a 38%
approval rating
and a 60% disapproval rating. Why would they want him out of there? He's helping the Democratic Party to win all these elections.
We'll pause there. We'll be right back.
In a freeway trailer, the horses flash golden manes. You puff the vapor and blow it off the windowpane. My heavy braids fall like ropes pulling softly at you, urging you to look in my direction. The dark hair at dusk flaunts her coral lips at sunset.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. A question as to, oh, you know, I wonder if the email server is working. Well, we have Rich on, and then we realize that there are a lot of people out there who want to weigh in. We're very excited. All right.
Glad to help.
Yes. All right, here we go. Kathleen writes, I get a smile out of the morning greetings and the introductions of the panel. While the panel is upbeat, Alan is like Eeyore of Pooh's Corner, sounding kind of down and sleepy. It always makes me smile. I look forward to everyone's daily greetings, especially Alan's, and then the ensuing conversation.
And I wrote her back and said, indeed, you're exactly right. The more it snows, ...
Right. Mike is very glad to have Rich back on the air. He has two questions for him. Rich, one, do you believe climate change is a serious and pressing threat to our economy and our lives?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Two, do you agree, as the president stated in his interview with the Washington Post yesterday, that the president has, quote, high levels of intelligence?
Yes, I do.
All right. There we go.
What proof do you offer to actually support that claim?
I was going to move on, Terry, but you're certainly...
On climate change?
No, on the intelligence part.
I think he's a smart guy.
Okay. Well, but
it was all about not his being smart. He was saying, yes, I'm intelligent, but that isn't what I'm operating on. I'm operating on my
gut. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about his
smart,
gut?
People with high levels of intelligence on this issue of climate change. I don't know how you square that. And this, I don't mean you. I just mean that argument.
Well, I'm trying to remember the quote. I thought that he said that he was listening to people with high levels of intelligence.
And he considered himself having high levels of intelligence as well.
But then he said when it comes down to it, he basically goes on his gut.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I actually think that's the sign of any leader. It's just if it's a leader in which you agree, you say, wow, you know, she or he has, you know, great instincts.
But you don't agree with him on that issue.
I don't agree with him on which?
On climate change.
I think climate change is a real thing. But I've heard him say that as well. Because when he was in the whole imbroglio over the California wildfires, and he was saying it's because of, you know, forest management, and somebody said, well, don't you think it's climate change? And he said, yeah, climate change is part of it, but he thought it was more what we could do more immediately was the whole deforestation thing.
And I don't know what happened in the studio, but it must have been the brightest light in the world because I don't think I've ever seen Terry squint as much as he just did.
I'm trying to sort of process this. You know, I mean, to me, the sign of a good leader is someone who is able to fairly examine all sides of an issue and then come to a solid conclusion and make a decision and take actions that lead to positive actions, hopefully. And I just don't see that happening with this person who claims to be intelligent. He seems to, as you had described earlier, examine all sides of the issue in sort of a constant way where the answers to the questions are continually changing. They're never still. They always go sort of like the tide. They're in one day and they're out the next. So you never really know where he stands. Therefore, he can't really make a decision. Therefore, nothing is getting done in this country.
See, I would actually say I think a lot of things are getting done. But I also, to your first point, I think, absolutely. He is, and I know you guys use it as a bad word, but he is absolutely more transactional than ideological. Right? I mean,
that's right. What do you mean by that?
The same thing that Terry was just saying, which is
But what do you mean by transactional? Because I agree that he may have some intelligence, and I agree that when he says he goes with his gut, but his gut always says one thing: get reelected, forget about anything else in terms of what's good for the country. Get reelected and go to the am I allowed to say this? Darn base. Go to the base every time. That's what his gut tells him.
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that. I think he stayed. I've said this before. I think he has stayed consistent on his core issues. If you want to talk about immigration, you want to talk about economy, you want to talk about security, particularly national security. You guys may all disagree, but I don't think he's been inconsistent on any of those. However, I think within large issues, he's willing to be transactional. To hear him say it, you hear a lot of people say it. He almost had a deal with Schumer. They were close. You know, I thought they were close to a deal on immigration. You know, some years ago, and he was willing to make some changes on that, including amnesty, if you want to call it that, which is something that would be anathema to a real ideological conservative, for example.
So I'm going to break my own rule, which is trying to interrupt myself with another topic. But I do think this is interesting. Where. And I understand what you say, and I don't disagree with you fundamentally, but he also does this thing where he blames people like he did with the Fed chair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but he hired the Fed chair, but he won't take responsibility. One of the reporters kept on going after him on this. He says, there used to be a sign on this desk that says the buck stops here. You're not taking responsibility for being the guy. All you are is complaining about the Fed chair, but you're not taking the responsibility for being the guy who hired the Fed chair.
Well, first, read the very last sentence of that story, because I think he actually does acknowledge at the end of it that, people made recommendations, but it was my decision to hire the Fed chair. You know, this is the kind of stuff that to us who support him, that kind of stuff is just less important to me. Yes, he shouldn't be hectoring the Fed chair. I mean, but yes, he hired him just the way he hired everybody else who he has ended up firing, right, at the end of the day. He hired Jeff Sessions, too. You know?
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, I think the problem with the Fed chair, not just knocking his own Fed chair, but like he's knocking the Fed and its decisions, and they're their decisions are a response to some of the things that have happened, like the trade disputes with China and not staying true to his commitment to closing workforce gaps and stuff like that. So I think that's, there are other issues happening that aren't even being attended to.
I was with you up until the two examples that you gave. Mm-hmm. I think that the Fed, is tightening rates because, the Fed is raising rates because that's a result of the economy, and he could claim it's his economy. So I think his rhetoric should be better about it. I don't think the Fed has, I don't think it has anything to do with the trade issues that are going on. I think it just has to do with the fact that the economy is starting to heat up. Also, remember the tapering the tapering of quantitative easing, started years ago. This is not new, right? We started, Europe, Mario Draghi has probably heard the same criticisms from people in the EU because they're just kind of starting their tapering process, and they're talking, what do they call it? They don't want to have a taper tantrum. I think this goes on everywhere. Him hectoring the Fed chair. Look, we know the Fed is an absolutely independent body. It's got to be that way. I think they're doing the right thing. I think, to me, when he takes issue with the Fed, it's almost like somebody jawing at the ref. Maybe you're not going to get this call, but maybe they'll think about it when they make the next call. And to me, it's not as big a deal.
But Rich, well, do you think he is, can I ask a question?
Sure, okay? Go ahead.
I don't mean to interview you, Rich, but I just. Do you think he understands that he is the elected leader of a country and that it is his job to reach out to all of the people that represent the various branches of government and the various agencies and to lead them together?
No, he doesn't understand that.
Because what he does is he actually the opposite. He criticizes the government and the people that are leading the government. And so how can you be an intelligent leader and operate that way?
Yeah, if you want to be elected again, that's what you do because you cater to that base. And one of the things that this guy, I want to go back to Rich here. One of the things that Trump is reported to be furious about is the shape of the economy. He's having all kinds of problems. In fact, this morning, the market, when I last saw it, was doing okay because it appeared he was willing to make a deal with China. And that because he is not happy with what's going on with the volatility of the stock market or the rest of it. That's all his fault.
I think his response to Terry's point. I think that is. His willingness to criticize people, I think, is a major weakness.
But it's not just people; it's his government. He's criticizing his own government. It's not just a person; it's literally the government that he was elected to represent that he's criticizing.
Well, but Terry was elected. I won't use the to drain the swamp, but he was elected because both overtly and covertly, really, the whole idea was the government's not working very well, and there's this whole kind of deep state, and that he has never had a problem with taking on those aspects of the government that he thinks just exist to kind of procreate their departments and things like that.
But what is he doing that's proactive to actually solve the problem? He hires new people. To replace the people he thought were not effective, and then he begins to criticize them, and then he fires them, and then he hires more people. He's actually running out of people to hire.
Yeah, and look, and I think I think he made some bad hiring choices, and I think he doesn't. I think, particularly, the Fed chair, I don't care about. I think Christian Nielsen, I think, is being, in my opinion, who I think is great, is being unfairly targeted by him. I understand that, and I don't think that's a strong point of his management style. But the whole reason he was elected was that there's failures in the way the government is working, and he was gonna make changes to that. And I think he has, and I think I know we always skip over all the statistics, but the economy by any measure is doing quite well. I remember, 5 years ago, we were being told, oh, the best we're ever going to do was 1.5 to 2% growth. Remember, that was the whole thing. That's what the new normal is 2% growth. Now we're doing 3.5 and 4, and unemployment is historically low. And the workforce, what's the the workforce number, people in
jobless.
But do you really accredit all that to him? He's only been in office for 2 years. How can you really accredit that type of economic change to one president in 2 years? Don't you think a lot of that was already put into place under President Obama?
No, I think none of it was. And I think the one single change was the perception between that the government is no longer actively working against you if you were in business. And whether that's true or not, okay, I think that was clearly the perception that business had with respect to the prior administration.
Yeah, the last thing in the world we can have is a government which is pro cleaning up the environment and threatening our children and grandchildren. And good for guys like you, Rich. We're gonna say, all holds off because this darn old government is getting in our way.
Yeah, I think that part of the reason he was elected was because there had been too much legislation by non-elected people. I think that the perception, and by that I mean, for example, too much legislation by agencies, too much legislation by judges, too much legislation by executive fiat and not real legislation. I know that he's bought into some of that as well, but I think part of, in answer to what Alan says, I think part of that is there was a perception, particularly among the business community, that non-elected people in these agencies who were there forever and were basically had untrammeled authority were enacting policies that were not consistent with...
Yeah, like the environmental.
Yeah, they were enacting policies that made it harder to dump your chemicals in the Hudson River. They were enacting policies that made it harder to dump your chemicals into the air. And now what you're saying is that this president has come in and made it possible for people to say, no, you can no longer regulate big business like this. We want to make it possible for polluters to have easier access to polluting.
But your question to me was, is Trump responsible for this economy? And my answer was yes, because of the most importantly, the deregulation. I'm not defending the particular items of deregulation. What I'm saying is that business felt like it no longer had an actual opposing force.
Who is
in
business?
The White House.
Who is business? Business are the guys who are running, or the principally guys, but the people who are running government and who have always had an outsized ability to call the shots. That's who business is. Let's face it. It's not a democracy that way. These are the people who are calling the shots. Right, Rich?
I don't know. I work with startup businesses all the time, and some of them are high-tech businesses that get all the ink, but some of them are, pizza places and restaurants and things that you see in strip malls and things like that. And I think they feel like there's less regulation, there's less taxes. I mean, we could argue about it forever, but I mean, I believe... I do believe that he has more to do with this economy, rightly or wrongly, than he's being given credit for.
We are desperately... I'm sorry.
We're desperately over.
I was just going to ask Rich real quickly. Are you saying that the pizza guy you represent is equal in power to the head of a major corporation?
I'll answer that after the break.
Wow. All right. We'll be right back after this.
You mark what you feed on. Take the wings of the morning and fly. Every I'm a tiny bell broken and drowning up in the sky. Lately I sinking into the night, rolling on through the iron and ivy till time out of mind. Every bit
Let it shine and shine and shine. The kingdom is flooding.
All right, we're back from the break. Rich, you want to answer the question?
I think the pizza guy on his own doesn't have as much power
back
as,
to the pizza guy,
as,
right.
as you know, the guys from Tesla. But I think that all the pizza guys and all the small business throughout America has a tremendous amount of power, creates a tremendous amount of jobs.
I want to quickly go on something that you said, and I just for clarification, and that is when you talk about the economy and the economy doing so well, one of the things that GM said in their announcement this week is bracing for recession. Is that something that we should all take seriously?
Yeah, I think you always have to wonder about that, especially just because based on the cyclical nature of the economy, based upon now, you know, the stock market's going to go down because rates are going to go up. But, you know, if GM were owned by, I'm trying to think of somebody you guys don't like. If GM was, you know, Halliburton.
That's a long list.
If GM was Halliburton, okay, or if GM was a bank, you guys would be all over GM. You'd be saying the same thing that Trump is saying, which is after you guys got all this money from the United States, now you're blaming, you know, what is it, 14,000 people in these layoffs? And now you somehow you're blaming what's going on in China. And now you're going to go actually make cars in China? I think that the GM's idea is, oh, we're getting ready for a recession. I don't think that's what they're doing. I think they're trying to cut costs. I think they're having trouble competing. I mean, GM's their share of I think SUVs went down from 27% to 24% or something like that, which is a big number, you know. And you know they're losing share on crossovers and things like that. I don't think that GM's worried about a recession. I think GM's trying to take advantage of, you know, going to China and trying to sell cars in China because China won't let us sell cars made in America.
Let us go to the letters. We have a lot of them.
Really?
Yes. I know. We're all shocked. Virginia says, is it true that President Trump suggested that we have a national government-sponsored news outlet that would counter fake news? Seriously? Thought I would lose my breakfast when I heard that. That is true. That was reported yesterday. We talked about it yesterday as well. Eliza says the economy is doing so well because Trump is running up the deficit. All capital letters, exclamation point. This growth is on borrowed money, and we have to pay the piper sometime.
I believe that's absolutely correct. I don't think that's the only reason the economy is doing well, but it's unconscionable. You know, where have all the deficit hawks gone? I think that's unconscionable. You know, he would say that we had to rebuild the military, and I'm not running up the deficit as high a level as under the Obama administration, and to the extent the Obama administration cut it down at the end of the years, it was because of the what was the name of the program where they couldn't agree and they ended up getting basically these austerity measures that and so we're using.
No, I'm sorry.
It'll come to me. Not quarantine. When Congress couldn't agree, they went to these preset spending measures that were that were well below, you know, what everybody actually wanted. But no,
I'm still on the pizza dealer. So what if one of those agencies, you know, a health agency, somebody else came out and said, okay, we're worried about rat excrement showing up in the pizzas, and we are going to impose a rule about that. Rich, because it wasn't an elected person. And by the way, the pizza guy would be going along with it just as the banker would be, don't you think?
I think there's already a rule against that.
Yeah.
And I think most of the things that people are talking about, there's already a rule against most of it. But you were going to say, Terry, you were going to say something about the deficit?
I'm just sort of caught up on the pizza guy now. I was just going to say, you had asked where did all the deficit hawks go, and I was just thinking that I don't think they've really gone anywhere. Some of them just lost their elections to Democrats in the House, but a lot of them are still in the House and a lot of them are still in the Senate. And I think what they did was they used that as a campaign issue in the cycle before this last one. They got elected, they took over control of government, and they shut up. And they started working to drive up the deficit to do all the stuff that they wanted to do that they knew that they needed to do to keep getting elected.
Yeah, with the exception of like a Rand Paul, for example, who stays, whatever you might think of him, he stays true to that, you know. But
meanwhile,
you're right, there's no one else.
As for the pizza guy, we all know that he's part of a human trafficking ring in the bottom of the pizzeria, right?
Wow.
And Pete Seeger is rolling in his grave because of what Rich is trying to do here, which is not where have all the flowers gone, but where have all the deficit hawks gone? It's a joke.
I've lost all the logic.
Okay.
Are we
ready
to say? Long time passing.
Sean says, this one's for you, Alan. For your from your conversation earlier, does Trump actually have the power to shut down the government, holding it hostage to try to get funding for his idiotic wall? Please advise.
He does. It depends on how crazy the guy wants to be. But if he says, no, I'm going to close down the government, not the first time that's been tried, he has the power to do it. It would be pretty stupid, and I think by now we know he won't.
Well, you know, this actually gets back to something Alan brought up earlier that we didn't finish talking about, which is, you know, what is the relationship now between Donald Trump and the Democrats, since they now are going to be taking over the House? I think that the president did serve a positive purpose for the Democrats during the campaign. He turned out to be very helpful to them getting Democrats elected.
Exactly.
Now that the campaign is over and the governing begins again, I do think that the president is going to be very problematic because he does have the power to block legislation and to work against the will of the Democratic Party. So removing him from office, I think, has to be on the wish list of many Democrats in leadership positions. It's just that they are, I think, smartly waiting until whatever investigation is happening to see what kind of actual facts come out of that, to see if they actually have the information they need to move forward with impeachment.
Spoken like a true ex-Democratic senator in the state legislature. However, I got to say, boy, am I looking for trouble. However, I got to say that I don't think this president is anything but great for the Democratic Party right now. And Nancy Pelosi is probably closeted with the top advisors and saying, we're not going to screw this up. We just won all these seats by doing it this way. We're going to keep doing it. Now, the difference between what we are hearing from Terry, I think, is that that's what a lot of Americans want. They want the guy out of there, and there's no question. But that's why they're voting blue.
Well, I think that the people that were just elected are going to have to answer to the people that elected them that we're hoping they would take aggressive action against this president and hold him accountable. I think this wall threat will be one of the first tests we have of that.
Yeah, I think it will happen that way. You know, they'll just go at each other, and you know, the next 2 years will be investigations and gridlock. I'm wondering, I'm hopeful, okay, cautiously hopeful, but I'm wondering whether the transactional part of his nature will allow him to maybe get some deals done with the Democrats, particularly those Democrats who were, I'm going to say, you know, less ideological and more, you know, we need to fix something. We need to, you know, whether it's immigration or healthcare or, you know, name. So I think that'll be the real test over the next 2 years. I know none of you have any faith in that, but I think it's possible that the fact that he's transactional and not ideological might mean that some things get done, you know, infrastructure or
so
something like that. I don't know. Maybe not.
We have to go to a break, but we will.
We just had a break.
Well, I know, but we were late for that one, and I don't want to be late for this one. Now this one, I've got to worry about Ray. Look at him.
Look at that.
We'll be right back after this.
Come to me like you come to the sea with bated breath on bended knee.
Kaya Cater playing Troy Savings Bank Music Hall Friday, November 30th at 8 o'clock, troymusichall.org. You can see the whole playlist at WAMC or the entire playlist at WAMC.org/roundtable. We have a ton of letters, so I want to get to as many as we possibly can in the moments that we have and hopefully move on to other subjects as well. You were reaching for a word before. Henry writes it and says Sequestration.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you very much, Henry. I really appreciate it. But that was, yes, that was the word. Thank you.
Patricia writes, love the panel discussion every day, even when I disagree, rarely and never with Alan. But today is especially wonderful. I love, love, love Rich Honan, even if I disagree, if I almost never agree with him about Trump. But he makes sense on every other subject, provides a refreshingly different perspective. Thank you, WAMC. Love all of you. And that's from Patricia.
Thank you.
Kevin writes, Democrats are too nice. There was absolutely no political backlash for McConnell stealing the SCOTUS seat. Independent voters did not see a problem with it in the 2016 presidential election, as their vote for Hillary was average at best. Democrats should they win the presidency and Senate in 2020, should absolutely add two seats to the Supreme Court. What would be the backlash? Alan?
Well, as we know, FDR tried it, and there was a huge backlash because of the concept of, you know, balanced government and each of the branches looking at each other. So I think it could be done. I think what may happen is what happened with the Roosevelt people. Historians may disagree, but the Supreme Court began to come around because they saw people were furious about, you know, stopping the Roosevelt programs. So, and of course, some of them got old and retired and got off. And that would happen again here, giving the Democrats some more chances. Although there's a lot of frustration with what went on, particularly on McConnell's part.
We have two letters, basically very similar. So I'm just going to put them together. One from Gino, one from Matt. Anne, who says, I believe the unusual part of the transfer of information, this is regarding Manafort, was that some of it occurred after the plea deal, when the idea of information shared with other defense counsels would normally cease. I believe the New York Times article, Rich and others, mentioned that once defendants make a plea deal, the defense lawyer typically pulls out rather than antagonize the prosecutors who can influence the client's sentence.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I agree with that. I agree with that last part, certainly. But I don't think anywhere along the process do you stop passing on information privately if asked.
Yeah, but the letter is really on the money when you think about it, because you've got a client who's going to now depend on the largesse of the prosecution in terms of the sentencing. He's already guilty, and you don't want to tick him off, right?
Yeah, unless I agree with you, and especially usually when you get a deal, you know, you tell your client, you know, shut up, don't say anything, don't do anything, don't leave your house, you know, just like in a corporate deal. You know, until the deal's done and the money's wired, you know, it's not done. Unless when they did this deal, Manafort, you know, went to his attorneys and said, look, I'll do the deal, but if they're asking me to say X, Y, Z, that Trump said this to me, I'll never be able to say that. So we're going to have a problem at some point. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what that conversation was.
Mary and Matt write both about Manafort. Can't Manafort still be indicted on state charges? Trump can't issue a pardon in that case. And Matt says Trump pardoning of Manafort would be done with corrupt intent and constitute obstruction of justice. The pardon power is not absolute.
Is that true?
Well, I don't know.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just asking.
Oh, no. It's true that the president can't pardon somebody who's convicted on state charges.
No. I was talking, can you look into the – I thought a presidential pardon was absolute and that
– Not over state charges.
No, I understand. No, I'm just taking the last part of that. Can you actually look into what gave the pardon and say that pardon
is an obstruction of justice
or isn't effective or something? It's certainly effective as to the defendant who's being pardoned, right?
Yeah, my bet is you cannot. My bet is that once the guy pardons him, now he can be held responsible himself. Trump could.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I have no doubt that once a pardon is issued, the pardon is issued.
Yeah.
We have a couple. We have a couple of requests of questions for Rich, so I'll go do those quickly.
Some of them are anatomically not possible.
No, not that one. Peggy. Peggy says, if we're allowed to ask questions, I have a question for Rich. Do you recognize that Trump lies constantly, making it impossible to believe what he says? You could take that in two parts if you want.
I don't think he lies constantly. I think that he...
Oh, come on.
I think that I said this last time I was on. I think he's a salesman. I wouldn't take all of his facts to the bank. Absolutely.
Isn't that a lie?
Sure, whatever. You know, if that's what you want to call it.
The Washington Post has counted over 6,000 direct, specific lies.
Are we going to start? And then are we going to start comparing this to all the other lies that every other president has told? And
Other guys do it too, so that's okay for the.
No,
but
I don't.
Yes, I would take that comparison any day. Yes.
Okay.
The answer to your question is yes.
I mean, the point is that, I mean, this is like the sky is falling, right? Or so if you keep on lying, when do you believe him?
Yeah, and I believe him on the big things. I wouldn't. I don't believe him if he says, you know, the stock market's up 160% or something until, you know, or 38% or whatever he says. I would fact check that. But do I believe him when he says, you know?
But aren't you concerned that the president of the United States can't even get the figures about the stock market correct? I mean, if one thing is easy to fact check, I mean, that's very easy to check, very easy to find out. Doesn't it bother you that the person who elected president can't even cite those basic facts correctly?
I want to know what Jen has to say.
I just think that, you know, it's just... I think that the president is... I'm trying to put this in, trying to say something that hasn't been said already. But I think, you know, I think I go back to what Rich said before about the president being sort of a transactional leader figure, and he will yield towards what fact or figure he heard that makes sense to him, no matter how new or old it is, no matter what the context is. You know, I think he has definitely been called out on false statements and untrue things that he said. There's a running dialogue on that. But again, I think, you know, I'll constantly argue, too, that, you know, yes, he is the leader of this country. But the fact that so many people are not, you know, disputing it, who have power to maybe make some changes on policies and in Congress, that's not happening. I think that's what troubles me as a citizen even more, is that these facts don't seem to matter. It's just what gets something else, whatever personal agenda is out there ahead.
Yeah, but I agree with that, but I'm not listening to it. I'm not going to have a national debate about whether the stock market at some point was up 38% or 24%.
It's going to change in 5 seconds anyway.
Yeah, I don't care. And whether he was lying or wrong, or I bet you will pick a time when the stock market was probably up 38% at some point or something. Maybe that's the number.
But I think that's where people lose focus. And I think, like, yeah. Again, with any of the other things that we've been talking about, you know, this meeting on China, which will happen on Saturday, what will be the outcome to American people, American jobs, and businesses, and whether it's the pizza guy or the, you know, distributor, what's going to happen to them? What's going to affect their wallet? I think that's these bigger issues at hand. And that there are some weird people who are out there that are weighing into this conversation. You know, the Cokes just came out with a report about how that'll affect people in the pocket, saying that it'll affect American citizens by like $1,000 or $2,400 per household. But that, why, you know, we kind of know where they stand, too, in that case. And going back to how money and other things inform decisions being made, I mean, look at the millions of dollars that have flowed into out-of-state. You know, we had the Mississippi election on dock today. You know, the millions of non-business dollars that are also influencing decision-making here in this country. And I think that's what's troubling, and that's what we don't talk enough about. I personally am so just sick of just tweet-watching and tweet-hawking that we're really missing out on some of these bigger issues that are going to have much more immediate effect to our livelihoods.
Alan, yesterday you said that you made the prediction that the Republican would win in the Mississippi race. You were absolutely right. The one thing I will say that I was somewhat surprised about, and because I thought at least it would be close, but she won by almost 8 percentage points.
These are the
was that one ever close?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was close enough to have a runoff. Right. I mean, it was like,
well, no, there were three people in the race. And so, yes. So, yeah, the answer is these are the sons and daughters of the old Confederacy and the grandchildren and the great grandchildren. And things haven't changed down there. Perhaps if Abraham Lincoln had lived, maybe we would have a better situation. But Mississippi is Mississippi, and even though there's 40% of the population of Mississippi is of color, the fact of the matter is that not everybody who could come out, even 5% of the people, or 10% more of the people who could come out, it might have made a difference. But it was as it always was, and when you talk about lynchings, it could be philosophical or it could be the real thing.
You're shaking your head.
I resist the impulse to indict an entire state or an entire part of the country.
Not me.
If she was a Democrat, you guys would be pointing out that Mississippi just elected its first female senator, which I think is true, in the history of the state. My only question was, I didn't think the race was that close. I think it's a solidly Republican state, isn't it? Trump won it by 20 points and
18.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I was agreeing with you.
But look at Orange County in California.
Yeah.
Solidly Democratic all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to the House. What's that all about, Rich?
California is nuts. California is just nuts.
We don't want to indict a whole state. Yeah, right. I get it.
I'm not going to indict a whole state.
I don't think you can lose sight, too, though, that, you know, like, SB is part of the state of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was running on different plans. And he didn't raise a volatile, you know, fight against the numbers. You know, he conceded, but you know, he acknowledged very much that there's still some divides that need to be addressed in that state, and I think that state does need to do you know, people of color in that state some more service than they have been.
I would say everywhere. Maybe more in that state than others, but I would say everywhere. I mean, there's divides that need to be addressed on every level, right? I wouldn't disagree with that.
We do have to note she has to run again in 2020. She was filling a seat of Thad Cochran, who retired because of health reasons. So she's filling out that term, has been elected to that office, and now we'll have to seek it again in 2020.
I agree with Alan. I don't think we should gloss over the fact that what just happened was that a woman was elected to a seat in a state by talking openly about lynchings. I mean, openly about lynchings. In
Did
the
she
year
say lynching or hanging?
Public hanging.
She didn't say lynching. I'm just
lynching. Either or. I mean, we're talking about a state that has a long history of actually doing that.
I think rhetorically, there's a difference in those two words. I think.
Seriously?
But, yeah, I really do.
We're going to debate the difference in lynching and hanging.
Well, I don't understand how the word morphed into a racially charged word as lynching when it was hanging, which is still not a great thing to say.
And by the way, that's what she said too, Rich.
Did she say lynching?
Same team.
I thought she said hanging.
No, she did. No, he.
And it was an ill-advised and stupid thing.
She agreed that it was a dumb thing to say.
But it's she's representing a piece of history, as Alan said, that is still hanging on from the Civil War. And it's not just Mississippi. The entire South is still hanging on to the last vestiges of the Civil War. And it's still there.
In some places it's changing, like Georgia.
It is changing, it's amazing how slow.
And it came very close.
See, it's so funny.
But not in Mississippi.
I feel like in the Democratic Party, and whenever I hear about them talking about, you know, resist and resist, defy, you know, I feel like the next word could be secede. You know, I feel like the Democrats, in many ways, harken back to those antebellum days. You know, more so. But I'm not disagreeing with anything Jen said. I think there's obviously, you know, divide. You know, there's racial issues, and probably always will be, and they need to continue to be addressed. I'm not going to indict an entire, other than California, I'm not going to indict an entire state.
Well, California is a much bigger state than Mississippi, so I'm not sure I understand how you can draw the distinction between indicting one and not the other.
California had 14 ballot initiatives. Whatever. I see things out there that to me just blow my mind.
It's a very liberal state.
Yeah.
It's a state where very progressive ideas have taken hold and been able to make good change that helps everybody. Mississippi is exactly the opposite. It has one of the lowest graduation rates. It has terrible public schools. It has very high unemployment. I mean, it is a state that is in great poverty.
But it's been in poverty for 150 years. doesn't necessarily, I mean, other than oil and gas, right? But you can't say it has the natural resources, for example, that a California does, or the money base that a California does. Yeah, I think there's you know, some states that have done better and some states that have done worse.
And you don't think leadership?
I think leadership
has anything to do with that?
I agree with you. I think leadership has a lot to do with it. I think racism has a lot to do with it. I'd like to think it has it's a decreasing part of the equation. I'd like to think that. Certainly, I think more so than 150 years ago. I understand we're setting a low bar.
Well, I mean, California had a very progressive leader as governor for quite a while, and he's done a lot of good things that have helped move that state forward. If the same thing had happened in Mississippi, maybe Mississippi would be in better shape.
Maybe. I think California also has there's an amount of money in California, because of the tech industry that's there, that covers up a lot of evils. I think when the price of gas and the taxes and the regulation, and you know, when you have that kind of inflow of money, I think you could ride that for a while. You know, we could say the same about New York City, right? You know, in New York City supporting the revenue from New York City supporting a lot of things that go on in New York State. I'm sure you heard that argument when you were there, right?
Absolutely.
So let's talk. We have about 2 minutes. Let's talk about China and the meeting on Saturday. The president has had very tough talk for China, but obviously has concerns and seems interested in making a deal. Alan, what do you think that could lead to?
Well, as I said earlier in the program, I think he has now learned that they're going to. That's the thing about a dictatorship. They don't move. They do what they want to do, and they're not going to move. But it is certainly possible to work out some of the things that need to be worked out in terms of intellectual property and other things, so that all the people who are suffering in the United States because of these new tariffs and everything else are going to have to be let off the hook, because it's terrible, and he knows it, and he's aware of it. We're hearing from the leaks in the White House.
But how do you think that's going to happen? I mean, how do you think that negotiation will actually take place? Effectively.
He does something, as the old saying goes about Vietnam, he's going to quit and declare victory. That's what's going to happen.
Meaning he'll
take some fractional part of a tariff deal and say, you know, we reduced tariffs.
I won this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Yes, I apologize. But we are out. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Rich. We'll sign you up for your next tour of duty. We'll be
Q2 of 19.
We'll be back right after this.